2005 Sunstone Symposium West presents Session 53, Spirituality in Music or the Gospel According to Peter, Paul, and Mary, a panel with Todd Compton, Laura Compton, and Glenn Cornett.
Okay, welcome to this session on, what's the formal title, Laura?
Spirituality in Music or
the Gospel According to Peter, Paul, and Mary. I guess I'll introduce the two other people. I'm Todd Compton. A little bit of my musical background. I started playing violin when I was in grade school, and I've loved all kinds of music ever since. And I played with a singer-songwriter for a while, as I'll tell you a little bit about. And I played in lots of orchestras. And in the last couple of years, I've been kind of assessing my musical, you know, taste and background and music in my life. And so what I'm doing will be part of that. First off, though, will be my wife, Laura Compton. And she's going to be concentrating on Peter, Paul, and Mary. Let's see, what more can I tell you about your background? She went to Humboldt, okay, majored in journalism, and both she and I now work in Palo Alto in law offices to bring in the rent check. But she plays piano very well, plays violin, and kind of the opposite of me, I play violin and piano very badly. Okay, and then
and she sings,
yes. And then we have Glenn Cornett. What was the phrase we had about you, Glenn, in the
probably roving minstrel and itinerant biotechnologist.
Roving minstrel and itinerant biotechnologist. And it's always fun to see him at Sunstone functions. And he's also a songwriter. And this might be your first premiere of these songs in a performance, mightn't it?
Yes, in a public setting, yes.
Yes, and his take on Mormon lifestyle and the Mormon community is very interesting. So I think we can start now. You're first, right, Laura?
Okay. I'll be first. Now, I have to tell you this little parable or something. My session, I kind of got this idea because one night I wasn't feeling too well, and so I was kind of vegging out in front of the television, flipping channels, and I came across, it was Pledge Week at the local PBS television station, and here was Peter, Paul, and Mary. And they were doing their 40th anniversary broadcast. So they did this special, and I started listening to their songs, and a lot of their songs kind of deal with, you know, peace and justice and love and protecting the environment. I thought, you know, a lot of these things sound like the same kind of things that we read about in the New Testament. So I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to go through and look at their music and that they've done over the last 40 years or so and see how it compares with what we have in the New Testament. We already had the harmony of the Gospels, you know, where you've seen the grid. It's got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and if it's Mormon, it has a little thing with the Book of Mormon on the end. It says all the events that happened in Christ's life, from his birth to his childhood to his calling the disciples and preaching all his parables all the way through down to the time of his trial, his death, and his resurrection. And interestingly enough, I went through, Peter, Paul, and Mary have about 400 songs that they have done in the last 40 years or so. And setting up a grid that included their songs to harmonize with the harmony of the Gospels was really, it was fun and it was quite interesting because they really have a lot of songs that kind of follow the life of Christ. I'm sure they didn't mean to do this. So I had this really cool chart. It had everything all set up and I was going to bring it as a handout so you could all see it and see how they paralleled, especially those of you who have really appreciated folk music. But then I lost this book a few months ago, and I needed it for an earlier session. And yesterday afternoon, right before we came up here, I found it. And I was so excited about finding it. I did this little happy dance. I put it in my pile, and I forgot to bring the Peter, Paul, and Mary stuff. So that's a parallel that, you know, when you have a lost, it's kind of like the lost coin, and the widow sweeps the floor and looks under everything, and she rejoices when she finds it. Well, she forgets to do a couple other things. So, but I have what I want to say, and I thought that we could make this a little bit more interactive for you. One thing I've noticed about LDS music, it kind of reminds me of Willy Wonka. If you all remember the scene where all the kids come, they get past the gate that's 99 and 44, 100% pure. They get past the gate, and they come into this garden, and there's this beautiful chocolate. Well, they don't know it's beautiful until they find out it's chocolate. There's this river of chocolate. And that river of chocolate's pretty good. You know, I mean, if I had a river of chocolate running through my house, I'd probably be pretty happy. And it's very satisfying. It's very rich. It's very tasty. This is like Mormon music. Sometimes we get so caught up in the river of chocolate that we miss out on the candy canes and the whipped cream and the frosting and the cookies and all the other things that are in the garden growing next to this river of chocolate. So I'd like to kind of try and think about it as, and this whole session of this whole spirituality thing, it doesn't have to be confined to one very small kind of music and one type of music, and you'll see that in the other music that we came out. So I think what I'm going to do, I'll start off a little bit. Now, there's a few parallels between Peter, Paul, and Mary and Jesus and his disciples. Obviously, there's the names. You have Peter, who is all three, Peter, Paul, and Mary are all disciples of Christ. We have, and they're all important disciples. And so, I mean, that's kind of a silly, obvious thing. And then there's another silly, obvious thing that Christ fasted for 40 days and wandered in the wilderness. And Peter, Paul, and Mary have been wandering in the wilderness for 40 years, spreading their gospel of social justice. A little bit more serious side, they have been working, they have borrowed from other songwriters and other poets, just like Jesus borrowed from the Psalms and the prophets of the Old Testament. They've also come up with their own new music and their own message, which also Jesus did. And another thing that was similar is that they speak in the language of the people. I think that if Jesus were here telling his stories, we would have fewer sheep and more computers and more traffic jams and things like that. And finally, they teach lessons with music, and Christ was teaching lessons with parables and stories. And finally, they all have some similar themes. And some of the themes that I've come up with, which I'm sure you'll recognize, is that they're very anti-war, anti-discrimination. Taking care of other people is important. Taking care of the environment is important. Enjoying life is important. Providing a voice for those who are unable to speak for themselves is important. And giving of yourselves is important. And we'll talk about that a little bit as we get into some of this music and talk about some of the legacies that this music has brought up. So the first one we're going to do, this is disc 3, number 20. Yeah. Now this song, I'm sure you will all recognize, it was written as a gift, and it was written by one of the members. You'll hear about it in a minute, but it was written by one of the members of the group for another member of the group. And because of this piece of music, there's been a huge nonprofit foundation set up. So we'll listen to part of it. You guys can tell me what part of Christ's life this might apply to. Maybe we won't hear it.
He is now to be among you, and calling of you.
So what images from Christ's ministry does this call to your minds? The wedding feast at Cana. That is my first one. Obviously, the idea of people coming together and joining in marriage. Now, I thought of another place where this might work. And this is when, at the Last Supper, when Christ is telling his disciples that when he's telling them, I'm going to leave, but don't worry, when you're together, there's going to be love there. Now, Noel Paul Stuckey, who wrote this song, wrote it for Peter Yarrow and his wife at their marriage. And Paul felt that he had been inspired, that this was something that came to him, and as a result, he didn't want to keep the profits from this song. The profits for all the recordings of this song have been donated to a foundation, and that foundation has created a kind of a wellspring for yet another program that Peter, Paul, and Mary have done, which is to encourage new songwriters to do similar things, to create songs that speak to things like domestic violence, saving the environment, social issues of our time, and they are encouraged to, they get a prize of like $500 or $1,000, depending on which they do, and they are encouraged to donate those profits to an organization that will benefit from that. So that's one of the things. The next song that I'd like to talk about, We don't have time to go through all of them, I'm sorry. This one is on disc 3 also, and it's track number 14. This is another one that's really famous, and, well, it's kind of fun. You know, they do a lot of songs. Some are more quiet, some are fun, and I don't know how much time I have, so wave to me when I... or seen them do this in concert. Of course, all the audience gets to participate. And they divide it up into three sections, and you get to be the toy maker sound. This song reminds me of the teaching, the story about which of you, if your son asked for a bread, would give him a stone, and that God gives us good gifts, and gifts that mean something to us. This marvelous toy brings wonder and joy and years of entertainment for generations in this particular family. And so God knows how to give us good gifts, just like we know how to give good gifts to our kids. Okay, let's
still have 15 minutes.
Okay, I got lots of songs. There were 400. Let's do another song. This one is going to be, this is a disc 1, track number 8. Actually, let's do disc 1, track number 9. This is another kids' song. Peter, Paul, and Mary did quite a few of them. And, you know, it's kind of nice because if you ever see them, there's an appeal it appeals to children and it appeals to the children in all of us. This is another one that I'm sure you'll recognize. And this one, I didn't really think it went with a specific thing, a specific part of Christ's life that was found in the harmony of the Gospels. But it could be thought of as a parable. And there is one of Paul's letters talks about this, kind of the story of this song, amazingly enough. one's really famous. This was one of their very first hits, and it doesn't have anything to do with drugs. What was the message that Paul had for his people that relates to this song?
Sorry, ask the question again.
I know you're overwhelmed by the singing. Okay, there's this song. I thought this song related to a message that Paul gave us.
When he was a child, he thought as a child.
Exactly. When I was a child, I thought as a child. Now I'm a man. I put away childish things. And this is a story about Jackie Paper growing up, and we all grow up, and we stop pretending in dragons and stop believing in dragons. And sometimes that's good, but sometimes we need to pull the dragons out of the closet and rediscover some of that creativity that we have as children.
When they perform this now in concert, they have another verse. They have actually two more verses to this, one of which has that as an aspect to it.
And they often include an extra chorus where Puff the Magic Dragon lives, present tense. He didn't used to live, he still lives. And the other thing they do now is, well, maybe not for this. Yeah. I know in the Marvelous Toy song, it's a father giving the toy to his son, but modernly they have been singing that the Marvelous Toy goes to the daughter, goes to the son and the daughter. So both kids are included.
The dragons live for never, but not so little girls and
girls and boys, yeah. They do that also. I knew that was there somewhere. We're going to do one that's a little more. That was one of the first ones they did. We're going to do a little more recent, disc 4, number 11. This song, again, is not necessarily another one from Christ's life. It's another one, but it happened to Peter. That's a hint. And I like this. This song is kind of fun. It's another one we get to play too. And I think you'll get the message pretty quick, so we probably won't be able to listen to the whole thing. I think they put the leader at the beginning instead of the end of the other one. While Todd's doing this, when I went through to line up all of the gospel, the music pieces with the harmony pieces of the gospel, I went up to Peter, Paul, and Mary's website, and one thing I found out that actually Mary Travers is battling some extensive cancer at the moment, and they're looking for bone marrow donors. But they had a really nice tribute to some of the work that she's done. You know, each of the... Although it says that the group has been around for 40 years, it's kind of like the same way the Relief Society has been around. You know, they had a little breakup in the middle. It wasn't really a breakup, but, you know, they kind of they got tired of doing 190 concerts every year, and which I can understand. And they had families to raise, so they stopped for a little while. They did some individual things, but then they came back together. Are we ready?
Yeah, weird technical difficulty.
Okay.
Do you want to talk about it?
Well, I don't want to talk about this song. See if you can get to check.
When you're doing interesting things, just one little tiny thing. They used to have a series of concerts at BYU called Pillow Concerts in Wilkinson Center, and Peter Yarrow performed there. It was really wonderful.
Peter Yarrow performing at the Wilkinson Center at a Pillow Concert. Now, one thing that was interesting, and I was learning about the group, that Peter Yarrow had some classical musical training before he came in, and Peter and Mary were the first two to kind of sing together, and they sang together in a duet in Mary's apartment, and they kind of liked it, but they thought, you know, it's missing something, and so they got Paul Stuckey in. And in the late 60s, Paul converted to Christianity, and he started talking about bearing his testimony, basically. It kind of made everybody a little bit nervous and a little bit uncomfortable and kind of caused some problems. Okay, here's the song.
Around 10 and see if it'll go through.
There's 2, 3, 4, nothing.
Huh, okay, well, we won't do this song. It's a really cool song. It's called All Mixed Up. It's got this little kind of reggae beat. And it talks about how our language comes from all different places, and our food comes from all different places, and we're all different kinds of people. And we're all mixed up, and it's a good thing. And the idea that I got from that was Peter's little dream about, you know, all the kinds of food that he could eat is okay, and it's okay to spread the gospel beyond just the Jews, that everybody else can have it. So we can't get anything on disc 4? Or...
Not after the first 3.
Huh. Okay, well, let's go to disc 5. No, this one. This disc that has been created, the profits from this, in the same kind of a theme for the group, the profits are being donated, or portion of the profits are being donated to a group called People for the American Way. And so a lot of the things that are on this disc have a strong peace and justice theme. How much, when am I supposed to end?
15 after.
Okay. Let's do number 2, but let me talk about it first. This song reminds me, makes me think of a couple of things. It's a song that talks about a big history of what Peter, Paul, and Mary have done, and it reminded me of John the Baptist. It reminded me of Jesus Christ. And it reminded me of Pharisees. So why don't you go ahead and...
It wasn't Caesar Chavez or Rosa Parks that day. Some say Dr. King or Gandhi that sent them on their way.
matter who your mentors are, it's pretty plain to see that if you've been to jail for justice, you're in good company. Have you been to jail for justice? Oh, why don't you shake your hand? Cause singing and lying down are ways to take a stand. And you sung the song for freedom or marks that picket line. Have you been to jail for justice? Then you're a friend of mine. Hey, you law-abiding citizens, come listen to this song. Laws are made by people, and people can be wrong. Once unions were against the law, but slavery was fine. Women were denied the vote while children were the minority. Yeah. The more you study history, the less you can deny it. Say a rotten law stays on the books, still folks with guns defy it. Have you been to jail for justice? Go on, shake your hand. Cause singing and lying down are ways to take a stand. And sung a song for freedom, or march that picket line. Have you been to jail for justice? Then you're a friend of mine.
Well, the law is supposed to serve us, so are the police. But when the system fails, it's up to us to speak our peace.
We must be ever vigilant for justice to prevail.
So get courage from your convictions, let them haul you up to jail.
Have you been to jail for justice?
These guys came and performed for a children's concert, a fundraising concert at Menlo Park, at Stanford a couple years ago. And Mary at the time had just had knee surgery, so she sat most of the time for this song. But when it came time for her to do that little line about get courage from your convictions, let them haul you off to jail, she took her cane and she was waving it in the air. She was very emphatic about the whole thing. There's lots and lots more songs, and some of them are more appropriate and some of them are more less appropriate. There was one that I wanted to talk about that we can't play. It's called Don't Laugh at Me, and this is a song that, but we're not going to do that one. We're going to do 115. See, they even have scriptural references. Chapter 1, verse 15. This one, not the one that we're going to do, but the one that is about Don't Laugh at Me, is a song that Peter Stuckey wrote, and it's part of a program that they use in schools called Operation Respect. And it's all about teaching children that just because somebody's different, that they're wearing braces, or, you know, you don't have to be my friend, but don't laugh at me because I'm different. And it has the most beautiful message. And it's a message that it enumerates all the ways that we're different, and not all, but lots of ways that we're different. And it really makes you stop and think to listen about it, to think about how we need to really respect each other. So this last one, I decided that since one of the last things that happened in the life, it's not really the last thing of Christ's life, but one of the first things that happened to the apostles after Christ's death was a pretty spectacular event. And so this song kind of reminds me of that. You'll probably see the reference. If you don't, I'll point it out.
How many roads must a man walk down before they call him a man? How many
The scriptural reference, Pentecost. And the wind in Pentecost was the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, the Holy Ghost, inspiring us to confirming our knowledge of Christ and inspiring us to move forward. And I thought that that was a good place to end, because it kind of brings us back to the whole idea that there is spirituality in all kinds of music and in all kinds of places. Todd's going to talk about some other kinds of music that have spirituality and meaning, and you'd be surprised at the huge variety of suggestions of spirituality that have come up in his section. So, thank you. And if you're dying for the list of harmonies of the gospel that includes Peter, Paul, and Mary songs, just let me know. I have it. I just don't have it here.
Okay. As I say, I began to kind of think about what great music is, you know, and also I was started getting interested in what is, you know, how does music express spirituality? And to think about this more, I organized a party where a bunch of my friends came down in L.A. And then we did another one up here. And I wasn't doing these for any particular purpose or for any Sunstone presentation or anything, but since I did them, I thought I would use them. And this handout that I've given you basically records the songs that were selected by everyone. Okay, and everything that says number one, that was the first party. Everything that says number two, that was the second party. And then some people couldn't attend or could attend, and they brought their own CDs. And I think Kim, the three, I think, is the secret's out. It's Kim McCall's choices. And four, I don't think Albert will mind. Those were some of Albert's choices. And then I just added a couple that I had chosen. Oh, then my friend who lives in Washington, D.C., are number five choices. And then I added a couple myself. And I suppose that music sounded nice. I suppose we could play a little bit.
Oh,
let me just start.
Oh, there's one in there. Do it on sermon number three.
So the rules for these parties were: bring a CD or a couple CDs of music that you regard as spiritual in some way. Okay, but turn it down. Okay. So I gave a arbitrary limit, you know, like 8 minutes, which could be two songs or one song, long song. Okay, and equally as interesting to me was the choices people made were very interesting, but equally interesting is I had them explain why this music had impact on them. And their explanations were very interesting. One thing I found about music is that it's almost a corrective to, sometimes you can have this very logical, analytical, skeptical mind, and music can be a corrective to that, to help you see the broader perspective of, you know, emotion and eternity. And I think music can express an incredibly broad range of feeling and emotion. Okay, so one thing I found when I did these two parties was people brought music against type. I played with a singer-songwriter named Mark Davis for a few years. I played violin, he played guitar. Sometimes we were in a rock group, amplified, and sometimes he was playing acoustic, as was I. And so I knew a lot about his taste in music, so I knew he was going to bring Waterboys, Big Love, or Van Morrison, Into the Mystic. But instead he brought a classical music piece, which is a very haunting, hypnotic symphony by Gorecki that I think I have listed there. As far as the explanations go, I remember one person chose Amy Grant's My Father's Eyes, and she said she chose it because she sang it in church when she was growing up and got to know it in that way. So there were lots of stories like this about how people got exposed to this music. So here are some of the conclusions I came to on why music impacted people as spiritual. Okay, first, often people selected music that they had sung or performed themselves, either in choirs or church congregations or in instruments such as piano or pageants or ensembles. And so one local example, one person picked the song Who Am I from the Oakland Temple pageant. And as a kind of an interesting sidelight, we later found out that Albert Peck had a roommate who would play that song over and over, and it's Albert Peck's least favorite song. But but for this person, it was the most spiritual. Okay, I also found out that sometimes people defined music as spiritual, music that was upbeat, that they felt uplifted them. And so an example here is kind of the quasi-reggae song, I Can See Clearly Now the Rain Is Gone. Okay. Conversely, other people define music as spiritual that was downbeat. and so some people chose music that expressed doubt and yearning, you know, to find the meaning of life. And examples are Lost in the Stars, Dust in the Wind, Karl Orff's Fortuna Imperatrix Mundi, which means chance, ruler of the world. Okay. Some people chose music that had words associated with it, which were overtly religious. Okay, and obvious examples are hymns or big classical music oratorios like The Messiah, St. Matthew Passion by Bach. However, other people chose music that had no words, such as the Beethoven piano concerto I have listed there. Or a prelude to a Bach cello suite, or the lovely slow movement from the Mozart clarinet concerto. Some choices were mystical, like the song we just heard, which was written by someone who practices Islam, a kind of mystical form of Islam. And it's all the lyrics are allegorical. But other choices reflect the social... Pardon? Dimming of the day. Dimming of the day. So, and by the way, I made a few CDs. So if you want to pick up one afterward, that's fine. And it has, yeah, I mean, I couldn't make it look good at all. But if you're interested in some of these pieces, they're on there. Other choices reflect what I call the social gospel, and a lot of what Peter, Paul, and Mary had kind of reflected that, you know, your compassion for your fellow man. And one example of that was Bring Him Home from Les Miserables. Okay, some people define spirituality as including humor or satire. Okay, as in, there's a Lyle Lovett song there about a preacher who just kept preaching and preaching, and everyone got more and more hungry, and he just kept preaching. And finally, the song ends when he finally ends and says, "Let's go eat." So that made me think of many Fast and Testimony meetings I've been to. Okay, I guess related to that is a certain type of music that people defined as spiritual that attacked received religion. So an example of that is Bob Dylan's anti-war song with God on Our Side. Or Don Henley's In the Garden of Allah, which has a satirical side to it, but it's critical of modern American culture. And Glenn Cornett will perform some songs, I think, in those genres before too long. Another thing I found, and in the party down in L.A., we had a number of non-Mormons who came, and I found there was a whole genre of Christian pop music that I knew nothing about. And so I, you know, they there were like four or five songs that showed up that I had no clue existed. But was very important to these people who had came from a Protestant tradition. Okay, relating to all these issues, there's some kind of philosophical questions. And so I guess one of the main ones is, do we experience spirituality in music through music itself or through the words associated with the music? And I guess that isn't important, but it's an interesting question to me. And that brings to mind my classic anecdote I like to tell about this. Years and years ago, I went to BYU Education Week, and they had a session on spirituality in music or something like that. The instructor started making a point. You know, he's saying it's very difficult to define music by itself as, you know, spiritual or non-spiritual. And this woman raised her hand and said, oh, but there's some music that's just inherently spiritual, like the music to Come Come Ye Saints. And his, you know, and he just smiled and he said, do you know that's a German beer drinking song originally? He said, originally that was a German beer drinking song. It was almost like he had her as a plant, you know. And so it's very interesting how we bring what the lyrics say, you know, to our interpretation of the music. I think often what does happen, though, is a composer, when he has a religious subject, sometimes it brings out the best in him or her. You know, like Handel with the Messiah, I think he was inspired when he wrote that, you know, but the material inspired him. So I think sometimes you have that great music with the great lyrics. But I think sometimes you have average music and the lyrics are so striking that it kind of affects how you react to the music. I think, you know, you could mention some hymns where I think the lyrics are very moving and the music itself is just kind of average. And relating to this, I sent kind of basically this CD to one of my old violin teachers, my very first violin teacher. And he sent me back a nice letter, and he said, he said some very appreciative things about it. He enjoyed it and everything, but he kind of chided me that I hadn't put more in that was music without words. And since he's a violin player, he had played in a lot of chamber music ensembles. And so he gave me a list of things like the Brahms piano trios and the slow movement from Beethoven's A minor string quartet. And so that made me think about how spiritual pure music can be, you know, without words, you know, and how sometimes composers really put a lot of spirituality into it. Into music without words, even without words. Tolstoy, toward the end of his life, developed some very interesting ideas on art, literature, and music. So I thought I'd run some of those past you. If you know his story, toward the end of his life, he kind of had a conversion to the New Testament. Though he didn't accept any of the supernatural elements of it, he was very much converted to the morality of it. Kim, do you think?
Sorry, several of us have either tuned out or talking to each other. Who were you talking about?
Tolstoy.
Tolstoy.
It's lucky you're a friend, Kim. You know. And so his whole aesthetic viewpoint changed, and the kind of fiction he wrote changed, and his views of music changed, and he came to feel like rhythmic music was bad. And so the most spiritual music he felt was slow music. And so he felt like the fast movements of Beethoven were immoral, you know. And the fast movements of Bach were, you know, not really moral enough. You know, but the slow movements he felt, and he picked out certain slow movements, he felt, you know, really expressed spirituality. And he picked out things like some of the nocturnes of Chopin and some of the slow movements of Bach. And, you know, I think he took it too far, obviously, but I also remember that another of my violin teachers, Richard Nibley, once told me, he said, you know, in classical music, it's the highest, you reach the highest points in the slow movements. You know, and with some of the great slow movements of Brahms and Beethoven's, they are like prayers. And so that's something interesting to think about. But then I also kind of react against that and think, well, come on, you know, rhythmic music can be spiritual too. But I thought I'd run Tolstoy's ideas past you. So if we ask what is spirituality in music, of course, we also have to ask, oh, why did that stop?
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Okay. Here's my summation, and then maybe at the end we can just listen to the. If we have a few minutes, we can just listen to the Mozart clarinet.
622?
Concerto slow movement.
Yeah. Well, he wrote two clarinet concertos.
Yeah. Just put it on like number 5 for now and see if it'll go. I have no idea what 5 is, but.
Is there going to be time for a discussion after
this? Oh, yeah. 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 I'll stop in time for that. And I would like to hear some of your choices on music that speaks to you. Here's my summation, though. If we ask the question, what is spirituality in music, we have to ask, what is spirituality? Is it the visionary, contemplative communion with God, or is it daily acts of kindness and love shared with your fellow human beings? Is it tragic experience? Say the loss of a loved one, is that spiritual, or the result of it spiritual? Perhaps we can say that our attitude towards such an event will shape whether we consider it spiritual. In the same way, we can ask, is tragedy such as Macbeth spiritual? Does spirituality require that we are overtly dealing with God, or can a walk in the woods be an spiritual experience? Is humor a spiritual experience? Is simple friendship with his day-to-day experiences? Or should we stick with overpowering ascetic theophanies? Is helping the sick and poor in a hospital a more spiritual experience than praying? Of course, both can be spiritual. Is romantic love a spiritual experience? And on my list, someone picked the love theme from Romeo and Juliet. You know, and at first you think, oh, is that, you know, divine spiritual music? But then you think, you know, that's part of the experience God gave us, isn't it? Is helping a political cause of more spiritual value to the world than contemplative otherworldly spirituality? So I'm just asking these questions. They're interesting to think about in relation to music. So, yes, I would like to hear some of your points of view. Could you come up here? And?
Well, I'm just curious about this fourth one from the bottom. Mozart's Queen of the Night is one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard, but the words are abominable. She's a witch.
I didn't pick that one. But I'll tell you the story about that. My friend picked it. He said that he was on his mission in Germany, and he and his companion went and saw an opera, which is the Magic Flute. And he said he heard that song, and I think the music spoke to him somehow. And he just thought it was the most beautiful thing he had ever heard. So that's his story for that one.
Well, the music, yes, but the lyrics.
So here's this interesting contrast between music and lyrics, isn't there?
Yeah, the title of that aria is "The Wrath of Hell is Cooking My Heart."
Really?
Yeah.
He says the name of the
aria
is "The Wrath of God."
Yeah,
what?
She's saying, "If you don't kill this man, I'm going to kick you out of my house."
Okay. You can talk to my friend Charlie about that sometime.
But
look at one. Look at his other choice. Does anyone know this song, "Cowliga" by Hank Williams, which is our only country western song here? It's kind of a funny song about a wooden Indian, you know, that they have on sidewalks and so on. And so I guess it's part of the humor element. But when he talked about why he selected that, he said he and his brother would listen to it when they were kids. And so he really associated that music with his brother and the warmth he felt toward his brother. And so, as I say, sometimes these associations we bring to these songs shape how we react to them. And other people will have totally different reactions. You had a comment, right?
Yeah, should I go?
Could you come up, please?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'm an artist, and arts in the church is very important to me. And it's also probably the most difficult conversation to have about art. And with music, the concept of aesthetic versus content, the message of a song is undoubtedly determined by the aesthetic of the music over the lyrical content. The great anti-violent song by Jimi Hendrix, "Hey Joe," simply by reading the lyrics, you might think it's a pro-violent song, but hearing the moanful, kind of woeful tone of this song, it is undeniably an anti-domestic violence song. And conversely, in the 1980s, there was a song that was written about child molestation that had an upbeat and kind of a playful tone to it. And the song came across as being sarcastic and strange. The aesthetic is what determines the song. And I kind of wonder, as far as lyrical content goes, what would John the Baptist sound like, ranting and frothing at the mouth, if his experience was put to music? You know, I kind of imagine that it might be Rage Against the Machine or some kind of heavy metal. I think if the prophet Jeremiah was put to music, it might end up sounding like Slayer, you know, frankly. Some serious, you know, hellfire kind of heavy metal. The church has been criticized as being insufficient in the arts. It supports people going after lucrative professions that are strictly designed for the making of money and supporting a family, which is understandable, to get to be a dentist or a doctor or a banker or a lawyer or some conservative, dependable profession. And the aesthetic that is allowed in the art, in the arts in the church, I'm afraid to say I feel like the aesthetic that's allowed is preciousness, which is really superficial, which confines artwork to Kincaid paintings hanging on the wall. I like Kincaid, actually. I think I've got a soft spot, you know. But what about challenging art? What about avant-garde type pieces? And when I hear what I consider to be church pop and church music, I really feel like that aesthetic is the only thing that's allowed, a kind of a preciousness that suggests that if it's not appropriate for sacrament meeting, then it's not okay and that it's bad. Spirituality in music, I hear a lot of spirituality in angry songs. Art is designed to reflect on the human experience, on the rage that we go through, the sadness that we go through, the joy that we go through. And I feel like music that you could define as church spirituality music is approval-seeking, and that it is designed so as not to raise any eyebrows of general authorities or mothers in the ward. And that's a real concern that I have, that artistic integrity depends on individuality of an artist's vision, as well as a dedication to uniqueness and a dedication to experimentality, and finding a new direction, which I cannot think of a single moment that I've experienced in with mainstream church art or music. So if anybody wants to respond to that, I'd love to hear what they have to say.
Okay, don't go. I have a quick question for you. Okay, you have to bring one song 3-minute song to this party, which one would you bring?
If I had to bring a song to reflect spirituality?
Or movement from a piece or hymn or whatever.
Right now, spirituality is almost like art. It depends on, it's captured in the eye of the viewer. And I could go out on a limb and I could frankly say that, you know, Jane's Addiction song, Been Caught Stealing, is an upbeat kind of humorous look at the thrill that somebody gets from shoplifting. Now, it's wrong, I don't know, but there's, well, to answer your question, the song I'm thinking of is Pink Floyd, Great Gig in the Sky. Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, is one of the most classic rock albums of all time. And the end of Side 1, back when they had sides before everything went to CD-ROM, is just a beautiful song about dying, where there's no lyrical content. It's just beautiful, really moving music with a woman wailing and wailing and wailing. And it's a song about death, and that has a lot of depth to me, and I would put that up as an example of a spiritual song.
Two more minutes, and does anyone else want to make any comment before we move on?
I really appreciated what John said, and he was sort of defending artistic integrity and the life of the artist and wishing that there were a home for the life of the artist, and I can imagine a response to that, which is, you know, go ahead, do your art, but that's, you know, what's the point of that in the church? I mean, and I have a couple of responses to that, but I want everybody to think about that. What difference, you know, I'm not an artist, okay? I have songs here that I think are fantastic, but how important to you is experience of new and different ways of looking at things, people exploring things differently, finding uniqueness of expression and authenticity in someone else's self-expression rather than just the normal old thing. I mean, to me, it's I'm hungry for it, even though I'm not an artist. And but I want everybody to think about how much difference does it make or not.
Okay, thanks for your comments. We'll turn the time over to Glenn.
I won't be held responsible for being articulate. I'm having Todd pass out lyrics to some of my tunes here. Those of you who buy the tape, what have you, for the session and are dying to know the lyrics, just email me. I'll be happy to send them. I did have some prepared remarks here. I'm actually going to go out on a limb here. I basically prepared a bunch of political and social satire tunes. But if I were to do one in that I considered more spiritual, not that these aren't spiritual in terms of expressing some of what I think are my more meaningful ideas and emotions, but I have something that at least would be less likely to get me thrown out of my current calling as ward music chairman for performing here. Now, I'll do that. I wrote this actually in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia when I was sitting there. I had just finished reading Conrad's Heart of Darkness, and I just wasn't very comfortable with that worldview that, you know, the horror as he's leaving life. I thought there was a better side to existence than that. So I sort of penned this one. This much I refuse to believe only darkness and horror. Nature dark at the heart of it all, watching men fall, darker, relentless. I see feel, hear, and taste, touch and embrace, much more than this. We parallel planes, two painful gains, too much my doing. Here now where ambition explodes, too many roads ridden without you. I seek, survey, and so hopefully know much more than this. Often I know, mainly the snow, frozen distortion, warming now to the touch of your voice, cutting the noise of my own making. Old ship touching new shore, knowing explore much more than this. Thank you. All right, and now I'll move on to the rest of my pieces here. I'll say this. I tend to feel almost radically moderate. At church, I'm politically moderate, so at church, the regular congregation might accuse me of being socialist, though I'm not. And here, some of you, I'm sure, secretly think I'm a fascist if you talk to me. And I'm not that either. What I'll have here, politically, these songs will lean more to the left, but that's because the right holds power at the moment, and I don't think are doing a great job. About a decade ago, the left held a lot of sway, and I didn't think they were doing a great job. And I had some lovely, fun pokes at them, but they're not so current at the moment. I'm delighted to be here. I uniformly find Sunstone a refreshing place to meet thoughtful people who tend to care sincerely about issues I consider to be of fundamental importance but are not necessarily appropriate for discussion in most ordinary venues. And heuristic I remembered from youth is that the three subjects best avoided during conversation were, in no particular order, religion, politics, and sex. Earlier in my career, I spent a few years working at Eli Lilly, makers of Prozac and other fine psychotropic medications. While I was at Lilly, Pfizer's introduction of Viagra became the most successful drug launch in history, and I became involved early on in a joint venture deal for a competitive drug, Cialis, which is on the market now as well. I worked on this for several months, being paid to read about, analyze, discuss, and construct numerous compelling PowerPoint charts regarding sexual activity. During this work, I heard numerous attempts at humor regarding the central subject matter of the Cialis deal. Particularly since that time, I've been happy to leave the discussion of sex to others. Reflecting such preferences, my music tends to address religion and politics. I leave the pontification on sex to different sources, many not sharing the constraints of my lifestyle. For my first piece, I would like to address what I consider to be some of the pettiness and disregard for human dignity that I see among some of the more vocal elements of the so-called Christian right, elements which I think to be neither Christian nor right, but rather hateful and wrong. Such elements are frequently referred to as fundamentalists, but I take strong exception to this categorization and this term, as I believe the fundamentals of Christianity to be love and service, not self-righteous hatred, nor avoidance of the so-designated other. I rather wish to refer to these people as literalists, as they tend to base their word on a somewhat homogeneously held, literal, rather poorly considered interpretation of the Bible. Given the homogeneity of this perspective and its strong focus on a literal interpretation of a single text, that of the King James Bible usually, I prefer now to refer to these people not so much as literalists. I rather refer to this particular group of people as homotextuals. So I decidedly am a heterotextual, at times a flaming heterotextual, I suppose. One of the ways to put forth one's heterotextuality is to portray in an appropriately absurd light the homotextuality running rampant in certain sectors of society. Over a decade ago, when such folks were trying to make our world a bit uglier, but this is before they ascended to their current heights of silliness and offense, I decided to set the Zormite Ramniumtum prayer to music as a protest song. For your review, the text is as follows. Holy, holy God, we believe that thou art God. This is from Alma 31, I believe. We believe that thou art God, and we believe that thou art holy, and that thou wast a spirit, that thou art a spirit, and that thou wilt be a spirit forever. Holy God, we believe that thou hast separated us from our brethren, and we do not believe in the tradition of our brethren, which was handed down to them by the childishness of their fathers, but we believe that thou hast elected us to be holy children, and also thou hast made it known unto us that there shall be no Christ. But thou art the same yesterday, today, and forever. Thou hast elected us that we shall be saved, whilst all around us are elected to be cast by thy wrath down to hell, for the which holiness, O God, we thank thee. And then he goes on a bit, and then sort of tails at the end there. Now as it came to pass, after Alma and his brethren and his sons had heard these prayers, they were astonished beyond all measure. I can only hope, brothers and sisters, that more and more of us will be astonished and then choose to act in that astonishment by doing something other than standing slack-jawed on the sidelines. Here, then, is a more modern setting of the xenophobic Zoramite Ramneumptum rant called Prayer from a High Place. It's it's sort of the middle of the third column of that lyric sheet. My wife is just showing up after I played the song that I wrote for her. Sorry. It's a nice song. Yes, I won't, but anyway. So there you have. So now I'm getting on to the little Zoramite piece here.
Oh, yes.
I wrote this when I was at UCLA and performed it from a neighbor who didn't move away afterwards, so I took that as a positive sign.
Holy, holy God, we know that you are God. You will be.
So I have to tune that.
We thy chosen few are free. Pious daughters, precious sons. We the few, the chosen ones. It falls, the earth it passes. No Messiah for the masses. Not defiled by flesh and bone. Only spirit claims your throne. Holy ever you.
Sorry, I hate guitars that are out of tune. I was blessed with a good enough ear to know when something sounded awful and not a good enough ear to fix it all the time. So. Oh my gosh, it's awful. Apologies. No, whatever. So, next tune, rounding out my religious satire pieces, I'll offer a tune based very loosely on my experience as a postdoctoral fellow in an artificial intelligence laboratory at a joint Harvard-MIT location. It was a true boffin's paradise, but there was a potential catch. The laboratory used WordPerfect, then owned by Novell, as its word processor, Novell NetWare as its network software, and Univel, a version of Unix recently purchased from AT&T by Novell, as its shell or operating system. This happened in October, November 93, not so long after the September 6th disciplinary actions. The paranoid fantasy emerging from this experience, and this was written as a joke, given that Novell was a Utah-based company chock full of LDS personages, that my church was able to spy on me in a remarkably comprehensive fashion. Hence the song's title, My Church is in My Computer. That is on your libretto at the very top left-hand corner. This was premiered shortly thereafter at the Ann Arbor LDS Men's Study Group, sometimes referred to as the Existential Crisis Club. The song was meant as a joke. Some of my Ann Arbor friends probably took it somewhat more seriously than I intended. All right. Let's see if I can remember this one.
Unorthodox thoughts from my node. Are there some hidden lines of code that in my face will soon explode? Low voltage electrocution. Am I the Antichrist? Thought crime polluter. Much church is in my computer. Committee, connective commuter, 28 level filtration, diluted my church is in my computer. You're in my network, in my shell, in my word processor as well. Do they get Ethernet in hell? Submissive sycophant, stable saluter, semiconducting cold silicon suture. My church is in my computer. Don't bother publishing, no need to shout. This is what religion so pure is all about. Enter into that closet, but don't come out. Neoconservative refuge recruiter, blue suit neocortical substrate rebooter. My church is in my computer. My church is in my computer.
Thank you. All right. I'll now move on to the manifold delights of the political arena. I start here with an apotheosis of fabled French arrogance. This was written as the French were busy swaggering in the face of global nuclear test ban with their own nuclear test activities in the South Pacific. After writing the song a couple years later, I took some amusement in French protests against American arrogance during the months immediately subsequent to September 11th. My view is that the French have superb cuisine, elegant language, and almost nothing to recommend them morally in terms of their nationalist behavior. One could perhaps more recently say the same about the U.S., minus, of course, the remarks about excellent food and eloquent language. But we will get to that later. For the next 90 seconds, let us celebrate the peculiarities of that land that was formerly and presciently named Gaul. Yes, just... I'm sorry, this is called Best in France. I apologize. Is that on here? Does that make
sense?
Right
after Best in France.
First column.
Just right after the one you did.
Oh, I apologize. Here we are. Yes, just one sitting will convince of how to live. They are the prince, fine Finnish color and bouquet. Of burgundy or cabernet, where pig sniffed mushrooms are high priced. Of truth.
of Descartes. General Descartes, not in three parts. Proliferation, not left to chance. May we make you invest in France.
Thank you. Next, I offer here a song I wrote shortly after being married when I guess I sort of wrote this to my wife, but this is more the theme of sort of global oppression of half our population. I wrote a song shortly after being married when I finally saw with some clarity the degree to which systematic oppression of women is alive and well, particularly in the form of cosmetological and sartorial norms. I call this piece Why Chromosome Cosmetology. It's a catalog of things one is not required to do should they be in the XY Club. That is in here somewhere, I think. Last one. All right, here we go.
If you have a call with oppression, don't have to know how to say thank you, sir, with the utmost of tact while you brighten your day with a balancing act. If you have one of these, you don't have to wear high heels. If you have one of these, you don't have to bow to your legs with blades to attack every visible hair for the view of society's tricks. With dresses and shoes to enhance your display, wearing tight nylon bags in the heat of the day. If you have one of these, but that we all if you have one of these, you don't have to shatter your chest with hooked up elastics, strategically placed through the circuit you suitably cast. No worries now with a lingerie line, jockeys or BBDs do you just fine. If you have one of these, you don't have to shackle your chest. If you have one of these, you don't have to cover your face with powders and creams from New York and Cali while you speak in the strict lower kiss. Oppression to rival a Ku Klux Klan, I'd rather be wearing a belly rag. Right. If you have one of these, you don't have to cover your face.
Thanks. All right. So this next one, we'll dive into, again, some of the more pessimistic parts of the artistic oeuvre, and then my response, which is generally more optimistic because I'm only 43, I still don't really know what's going on, right? In keeping with the theme of surface versus substance, I'll present here a response to T.S. Eliot's Whispers of Immortality. This is one of my favorite poems of his. In this poem, he describes the death lurking beneath the surface of life, starting off as follows. Webster was much possessed by death and saw the skin, daffodil bulbs instead of bulbs from the sockets of the eyes. He knew that thought clings round dead limbs, tightening its lusts and luxuries. Done, I suppose, with such another who found no substitute for sense, to season, clutch, and penetrate, expert beyond experience. He knew the anguish of the marrow, the ague of the skeleton. No contact passable to flesh allayed the fever of the bone. And Eliot breaks this in half with some dots, what have you. And then he gets us to the present tense. Grishkin is nice. Her Russian eyes underlined for emphasis. Uncorseted, her friendly bust gives promise of pneumatic bliss. The couched Brazilian jaguar compels the scampering marmoset with subtle effluence of cat. Grishkin has a maisonette. The sleek Brazilian jaguar does not, in its arboreal gloom, distill so rank a feline smell as Grishkin in a drawing room. And even the abstract entities circumambulate her charm, but our lot crawls between dry ribs to keep our metaphysics warm. I take a contrary, more optimistic position in the following song, though I suppose the piece takes a while to get there. Eliot chose to emphasize death beneath the surface of life. I instead choose to celebrate life beneath the surface of death. The fact is that most of what is visible on the human body, the skin, is actually dead tissue, the stratum corneum of the epidermis, to be precise. Even the cornea through which one looks into the eyes of others has dead tissue as its outermost layer. Beneath this dead tissue, however, prospers a dynamic milieu that, if not miraculous, is at least more interesting than the prospect of decaying bones, and can actually provide, at a minimum, entertainment to the less imaginative and, ideally, joy to the more perceptive. So Eliot starts with surface of life and ends at the substance of death. I start with the surface of mortality, with the refrain, most of what you see of me is already dead, and at least endeavor to end with the substance of life. The song is titled Exterior Decorating. And it's bottom half of the second column.
Deeper layers of changing clothes in within. Much of what is visible is crying in bed. Just relax, this barrier is keeping us insane. Where there is no feeling, there is also no pain. Exterior decorating is a half-fashioned thing.
How are we doing on time? We are actually near the close. Let's see. What am I going to do here? Let's do some triage.
About 7 minutes.
Yeah, okay. So I actually have two more tunes. So be very quick here. I wrote this one about 15 years ago, celebrating that pinnacle of dyspeptic capitalism, the beer commercial. You remember the Why Ask Why Try Bud Dry commercials? Someone's asking a deep question, such as, how come no matter what woman I'm with, someone else looks more interesting that night? Or how come I'm complete philistine when it comes to appreciating other cultures? So they start asking this question, then the voiceover comes on. Why ask why? Tie bud dry. You know. So I penned a little tune in response. It's the bottom of the third column called How I Was Emancipated by Madison Avenue. That you must play on Saturday night. Just pull the chains between your ears and you will turn off the light. When all romantic adventures of life have become your complex, when you'll be followed by things that make sense to the opposite sex. Why ask why? Why ask why? The fault of life will never clear. Why ask why? Why ask why? Why ask why? Don't ask. Have a beer. If you spend too much of your check to look like you are successful, if after 25 years you discover that you are still dull, corner offices treat you like you're just one of the mob, but you enjoy it because you know you have a really great job. Why ask why? Why ask why? I could do my last tune here. We got time for one more? Squeeze in. All right, this is my tribute to the Patriot Act, which in its implementation nationally and its attitudes projected internationally, I consider to be one of the most serious compromises of human dignity perpetrated by this country during my lifetime. The title, Bob Knows You're Here, came to me about a decade ago as another paranoia-inspiring title, kind of like my churches or my computer. I thought it was really funny at the time. As the Patriot Act rolled out a couple years ago, this song wrote itself.
Scream if it is too.
Thank you for your indulgence. All right.